Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. We are keeping it real, and I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is Morgan Miller of the Class Struggle Action Network. They're moving forward with all kinds of actions and projects. Thanks for coming in, Morgan.
Thanks for having me, Lisa.
When I was scraping all of the barrels to look for activist organizations that I could write about and stuff like that, I was stunned to stumble across the Class Struggle Action Network. And by the way, it's a really hard thing to ever try to, quote, Google, unquote. You don't have to Google things. You could just look them up online. But you pull up all kinds of action networks. I'm fascinated by it. So what is the Class Struggle Action Network, and how did it come together?
We're relatively new. It's a grouping that came out of the Portland City Strike. Activists participating in the Portland City, the Water Bureau strike, and that we were inspired by the efforts of coordinations, or what they're called in Italy, or networks, which are groupings of networks of militant workers trying to aid each other's struggles.
Really very much labor union based, but not limited to labor unions.
Primarily focused on workplace struggles. We're not trying to be anything outside of that. If something happens within the unions that demands that we're not opposed to it, if that makes sense.
I come from a labor union family, and there's a lot of bureaucracy, and there can be a lot of groupthink in labor unions too. So the sense I get is that, no, I want you to actually describe a little bit more the organization, because I'm seeing cool stuff that it looks like people who are part of Action Network have been studying and doing pro-choice demonstrations for like the past 5 years or so.
You're confusing me with something else.
Okay, you. Confusing you with something else.
Confusing us with something else.
All right. Yeah. Well, tell me about all of it.
A similar organization here in town, or similarly named organization here in town.
But Class Struggle Action Network is having an event in June 17th.
Yep.
Right, at Laurelhurst Park. It's Class Struggle Action Network potluck barbecue, Saturday, June 17th. Meet comrades, share food and fun, plan cross-sector working class solidarity for this summer and beyond. So there's things going on and people to hang out with. So tell me more about it.
It's a classic thing to do for the summer for working people, we're just trying to increase the outreach and find more people who are interested in participating. And
so independently of the unions, but about workplace struggles.
We're independent of the unions in that we're not sponsored by any, and we're not trying to be necessarily a faction within any of the unions to push it one way or another. Well, we do want to push it one way or another, but not as a formal section of the union.
Not as part. I want to refer to it as the bureaucracy, not as part of the bureaucracy, the organizational structure of the labor union. Because the city, the county, the state, they actually have a lot of different kinds of labor unions for white collar workers, laborers, all kinds of unions that you almost never read about in the newspaper or see on the news.
Right.
And that is something I wanted to ask you about a little bit later. But Class Struggle Action Network had a really cool event on May Day.
Yep.
Can you talk about that? What was it?
We had basically an open house coming out party. You know, hey, we're here at a bar up on Stark Street called Experiment. We had attendance of 70 people. It was a spur of the moment thing. We just called it and did it within 2 weeks because it didn't look like there were any other May Day events this year, and just decided to do something.
Morgan, I have been seeing you around this town for a few minutes. Okay, decades. You're one of the people that I can think of when I was young. You were young, and we were doing things, but we didn't do things at the same place. There was so much going on back in the 80s and 90s in Portland, mm-hmm. so much political organizing. Can you talk a little bit about why did so many people come on May 1st to the Experiment Bar, and what did you guys talk about?
We were talking about our organization and, you know, our plans and our what we would desire to have happen, and trying to find like-minded people. What were people thinking?
I mean, you know.
No, why did they come? why did they come out? Because there's a severe lack of this sort of organization in town. It's been abandoned for the most part. And we just decided to go for it. And we got, there was a certain resonance there.
When you say the downtown is shut down and there's not a lot of people organizing around stuff, I remember watching the civil unrest in 2020 and waiting to find out more about the people that were organizing on the ground and waiting to hear more about organization in general. But I realized that the current crop of reporters, whether they're local or global or national, literally don't know how to cover movements. They don't know what they are. So they didn't know that they could ask certain people or even look for certain, I don't know, trends or tendencies in terms of how those 200 nights of protest rolled out. I mean, I have to ask another person who's been out here organizing people for so long, what did you think about that moment in 2020 when I feel like a lot of people that have never, ever been in the street before just flooded the streets? Did you see something like that too?
I wasn't there. I was in Denver.
You were in Denver, but yeah. You watched it on the nightly news.
No.
No?
No.
You were able to just completely get away from it?
Yeah.
Okay. You didn't hear about it at all?
A little bit.
Okay.
But I didn't follow it much.
Why not?
I don't know.
Well, how come? tell me what brought you then to this activity now. Besides, there wasn't a lot of people doing it. There's a lot of people not doing a lot of things. But getting 70 people to show up for May Day at the bar, and they were actually doing that thing where they were struggling and learning things. What made you decide to actually get up out of your chair? This is you, man. If you just tuned in, I'm Lisa Loving, and this is Keeping It Real. I'm with someone who I have not known very well for many years, and I've almost never heard speak very much. And that's why it fascinates me to see you organizing people.
Because this is needed. I think this is needed much more than protests on the street. And that's from an old guy that used to protest on the street. I see that that's kind of a dead end, personally. And it's getting a little uncomfortable because I'm speaking for myself and not the organization.
Right. Understandably.
Yeah.
Understandably. Could I ask you about other people in the organization or who else is involved? Like what kind of people? For people, my goal is for people listening now. I want people to listen to this show, Keeping It Real. And I want people to learn about people in our region that are organizing people to do something, a goal, whatever it might be. And because I'm sure that there's other people out there right now that are thinking there's a need for something, but how would I just go out there and do it? So, Morgan Miller, as you thought about this need, mm-hmm. because I see people, the civil unrest in 2020, I thought was amazing because it seemed like a whole lot of people were were coming alive and they were realizing who the other people were that were like them. To me, that's the value of street action. When you get a whole bunch of people and they realize they're not alone and they see, they can quantify how powerful this power could be if it could be flowed into different channels. So, for anyone who's listening now and they're thinking, I want to go to a potluck in June in Laurelhurst Park. I wonder what kind of other issues, what kind of people are going to be there? Like, what kind of issues?
Okay. We have a couple of hundred people, on the mailing list that we're trying to mobilize for this. We have people, contacts into, I think it's 22 unions right now. Difference between on the streets and this is that on the streets or the public, it's anybody of any class. And you don't necessarily have the commonality to exact social power as you do in workplace actions. And that's the difference in the focus, I would say.
That's so interesting. One of the things that I've seen in the past few years, I feel like I've dropped out of everything in the past 5 years. I watched the 2020 civil unrest from a distance also. Mm-hmm. I thought to myself, you're an old woman. You take up so much space. Let the young people go and do the young people thing. And then I was amazed and fascinated by the people who went out there who would never do anything like that. And what did they do? And what did they organize? That mm-hmm. always does fascinate me, because I remember when the Occupy movement happened. And I remember thinking, what's going to come from this? And I remember at the time thinking, nothing came from this. But actually, several organizations got together and started mobilizing to do specific things during Occupy that kept doing things. And I do think it's about finding your other people. But this is what I really wanted to ask you, though. Were you an Earth Firster?
I was around it. I come from an old wobbly family, and that's the history that I come from. So it's primarily working class attitude, and with an emphasis on attitude. I was around Earth First friends.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. I was for Earth First adjacent, and I just thought, God, they're such jerks. The men never wash the dishes. I'm not going to be part of their movement at all.
They never wash themselves.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Earth First. But I was thinking a lot about Earth First lately because I was watching the coverage of a movement in Georgia called Stop Cop City. Mm-hmm. And I saw where young people of color out there outside of Atlanta are using some Earth First tactics to protest against the complete leveling of a forest for a law enforcement training facility. Mm-hmm. And that fascinated me. Earth First, they would have been very arrogant about that if they had known back in the day that was going to happen. They would have been arrogant. Look at me. I'm talking about how arrogant is Earth First. But I guess the point I'm making is, Portland, Oregon is famous for activism, always has been since I moved here in the 1980s. And it is strange to me to see how little coverage of activism anymore. But I'm convinced that there's people doing it everywhere, but we just don't hear about it. I just had to say that. Can you, years ago, I was at an event with my friend Leslie Hemstreet, and it was something about Earth First. Mm-hmm. And you were there too.
I think we spoke together.
Yeah.
We were both on the panel.
Yeah. And can I ask you to describe who the Wobblies were and talk about your family's experience as Wobblies? Is that too much? You don't have to do it.
It's a bit too much.
It is. Okay.
I want to just keep it away from me focused and more on the organization. But the Wobblies were a famous militant union. Formed in 1905, were extremely powerful in the Pacific Northwest, and still exist.
Still exist in a number of different industries.
Yeah.
Now, and I just talked about Stop Cop City and the young person who was killed there by the police. The Wobblies also faced absolute violence from the Pinkertons. The Pinkerton I want to say they were called a detective bureau, but they were really mercenaries on a certain level. And
private cops.
There you go. Can you see any similarities between now and then?
Yeah, capitalism still exists. You know, the profit system still exists. You know, the social relations of wage labor and profit still exist. And so there's still a need for similar projects, but we have to learn from the mistakes of the past.
Learning from the mistakes of the past is the key, huh? If you just tuned in, I'm Lisa Loving. This is Keeping It Real. We are trying to keep it real. My guest is Morgan Miller of the Class Struggle Action Network. They're having a big, a fun event on Saturday, June 17th at 6 p.m. in Laurelhurst Park, made up of workers from 20 different unions fighting for a renewed combative class union movement. And that's what we're talking about, a little bit about this organization that has, when did the organization emerge?
It emerged May 1st.
Did it? May 1st at your event that you had at the bar?
Yep.
What were some of the things that people were, it looked like people were actually studying.
You know, I wasn't able to be there.
Okay.
I was on the road.
On the road.
Hopping freights.
You're always traveling. Can you talk a little bit more about, is there anything in, how does the Class Struggle Action Network meet? Do you guys have Zoom meetings, or do you come together, or do you talk on a digital document or something like that?
We are still working that out. Currently, we're having big meetings once a month, and then there's a steering committee that is meeting more frequently.
What are some of the victories that the group is finding? Like, it's not easy to come together and try to organize, especially around class struggle, because many people now don't even know what that means.
Yeah, agreed. I can't say that we've won anything. We're brand new. You know, we're just trying to get out there. You know, it's like we were inspired by what appeared to be a very militant strike, or not a very militant strike, a well-done strike at the laborers conducted at the Water Bureau. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? When was that, and what did they do? Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. Morgan, what if you were on a radio show to talk about this emerging organization? What would you want people to know about it?
I want people to know that you're not alone. There are other people that are looking out for better methods to get out of the conditions that we're in.
As you guys are coming together and organizing, are there places that you find that are really good places to get information? Like, are there places, I'm struggling to find more information about the activist community anywhere in Portland. Are there places that you guys find that?
I've just moved back to town. I do not know. I know there's the usual spots, you know, like Workers' Tap. You know, Workers' Tap, right?
No, what's that?
It's a collective tavern just up the street, Ankeny and 11th.
What are some of the other places that, you know, when it comes to some of these issues, I've been thinking how small businesses actually traditionally have a piece of class action.
Yeah.
Can you think of some other places?
Kind of, yeah. But.
Yeah, I mean, even just providing a place to meet, which is actually a difficult one.
Yeah.
Can you think of other places in Portland that traditionally have been just hubs of community around organizing?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm I've been gone from pre-COVID. I was out tramping, and I've been gone since pre-COVID, just got back, and just starting to learn this, my city again.
Is it your city still? What has changed about it?
I think it's better, actually. I like that it's more international. It's much more cosmopolitan. The food scene here is wonderful. There's a lot. Unfortunately, some of the negatives is that the rentals are so high that you can't have those centers of art and creativity and collectivity like you used to be able to.
Yeah. Before we turned on the machine, we were talking about how long you've lived here. The thing about Portland, it's one of those places where there's so many newcomers, it seems like, all the time. But and I don't want to get too much into your personal life, but there's a lot of us, a lot of people are led by the tail when it comes to Portland, Oregon, should be a certain way or it should not be a certain way. And yet what I miss about it is I feel like I miss an old Portland. I miss that I could afford it. And I didn't have to go to a fancy restaurant or anything like that. There were always people living in the street, always people here. And yet now it just seems like there's too many. There's a lot of rich people. There's a lot more rich people, I think, than there were before. But am I imagining that?
Yes and no. I mean, that's another thing that gets back into wage issues, that the reason why things are too expensive is that wages have not gone up. That's because the class struggle has been abandoned, was abandoned for decades by the unions, by the general population. It was seen as old-fashioned when I was growing up. You know, it was something your dad did or your grandpa did, but it wasn't something that we did. We had cultural struggles to do. And, I'm saying we should go back to what dad and grandpa and grandma and grandma and mom did.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but I do see it now that you mention it, the difference between class struggles and cultural struggles. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk about that a little bit more, though? Like, I feel like where I've been, it seems like everyone divided into identity politics is how mm-hmm. people will describe it. Can you just talk about that a little? What's the difference between class and identity?
Class is a it's a difficult question. It's not unanswerable. Class is a forced collectivity that's enforced by the economic system.
Wow, forced collectivity. Yeah.
And, you know, we all have things in common as workers. It's forced, and it doesn't matter what the color of your skin is, your gender identity, your any of those identities, you're forced to work together. You're forced to produce profits. It's systematic. It's not good guys versus bad guys. It's a system. It's the way that the system is structured. And so that's why class is fundamental versus identity.
I hadn't even thought of it that way. Because when we were looking at the civil unrest in 2020, it seemed it was all cultural. And yet, I don't know if that's accurate. And when you look at, when I looked at some of the ways that some of the baby movements that emerged, they seemed to fracture along class lines. Mm-hmm. Even the dads that had
the power mowers.
That had the leaf blowers. That's what it was.
Yeah.
And it just seemed like every single aspect of class wound up being a complaint about culture.
Right.
Wow, Morgan. tripping me out thinking about that. I mean, there's just still this part of me that looks at the big civil unrest of 2020, and I feel like that was it changed the history of our town somehow. It was so seminal, and yet I'm struggling to see what was the long-term change of it. But at the same time, the people that own this town, the people that run the Business Journal, don't want us to think about stuff like that.
When did you get here?
I arrived in Portland, Oregon in 1987.
Okay. So you remember Little Beirut.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, you know, was very similar.
So just to explain for listeners, Little Beirut. So there were a series of large protests in downtown Portland around 1990 or so. And they involved Republicans in office. One of these George Bushes, heaven forbid I get them mixed up. I think it was the oldest one.
Yeah.
Was it he who actually said Portland is like Little Beirut?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where that came from. We used to be I've been beaten up by cops before.
It was just a big riot every time that the Republicans showed. And it also tied in with all the anti-skinhead, anti-racist action stuff that happened was concurrent at that time. That was covered in the podcast. It did happen here.
It did happen here, which is by some wonderful people who were emeritus from KABU. We're still collecting that history, even though it's obvious and it's ugly and it's really big. And you could see how it would be all connected. I have to say, I thought that African American people and African people would stop being murdered by white people violently in the street back then. But now I'm not sure that that's possible.
Okay.
Anyway, if you just tuned in, I'm Lisa Loving. This is Keep It Real. We're with my old colleague Morgan Miller talking about Class Struggle Action Network. We're kind of trying to talk about it. Morgan is unique, though. Morgan is not like the other people that walk in here. Morgan is Morgan, and he lives in Morgan World. And I try to think of the first time I ever met you. I think it was maybe I saw you at so many things, but it was back in the early 2000s, the event about
Judy Berry.
Judy Berry, yeah.
It was well before that. I think it may have been KABU back then, but I don't know.
I keep wanting to ask questions, but they're personal, so I stop myself because you don't want to talk about yourself. But you have been here at KABU. You have emerged in the KABU space at different times along the 50-year trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you, what was it like at KABU when KABU first started? Were you there in the first 5 years?
Yeah.
What was it like there? Who was there?
Who was there? Bunch of hippies. Primarily Reedies. It was less left and more libertarian at the time. The concept behind KABU at the time was to give anybody a half an hour on the air. And I came in because I was in love with radio. And they said, oh, it's really cool that we could have a 12-year-old disc jockey. And they just set me up and let me go. Yeah.
What did you put on the air? Or is that too personal?
My first show was all... what was then called world music.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So like African music, Iranian, Indian... that sort of stuff.
I used to have a world music show on KABU as well in the early 2000s. And I don't even know what people call that anymore, but I don't think they call it that anymore. The things that have changed and the things that have not changed in the city of Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
So, Morgan, for people that are listening now and they're interested in activism or they're interested in getting active, do you have any suggestions for them on what kind of issues or what kind of actions they might bring to the Class Struggle Action Network. What would you like to see there?
Come, if you're interested, you know, we're going to do what we're going to do. Come, make a proposal, make suggestions, and we'll work it out. You know, if we have all sorts of, you know, intricacies in decision making that has never been done before.
Like what?
Well, you know, it's like if somebody comes in and says, oh, we need help on X, Y, or Z. You have to say, well, do we have the resources to do this? What is our approach going to be? How do we approach this on a class basis versus a community or a public, you know, a wide group basis?
You have a governing structure. It's a specific governing structure.
It's an advisory board.
Okay.
It's not governing, it's advisory.
I kind of wish this was video, kind of, but one of the most difficult things about organizing, my friend Jamila Bourdon, who for many years was a KBOO programmer, she's with the All African People's Revolutionary Party, mm-hmm. and she'd say, if you're not organizing, you're not doing anything. If you're just sitting at home posting things onto a page, you're not doing anything. You have to go out and be involved with people. And yet that is the hardest thing.
Yep.
I find that to be the hardest thing.
Mm-hmm.
See, I keep wanting to ask you more questions about yourself, and I know that you don't want to talk about yourself, but I know that you're one of...
I mean, you can ask. I'll just deflect to...
Okay.
That's something more... We should talk about the organization and not me.
Right. Although I will say, people such as yourself are people with long histories in these spaces, these activist mm-hmm. spaces, these cultural spaces. So to be able to ask you questions about, say, for example, the Wobblies and what they've done, mm-hmm. especially the obstacles that the Wobblies faced, that one is really getting me because, again, I would have said that in the 20 whatever century this is, I'm stunned that people who are organizing, doing community organizing, are still getting shot in cold blood, shot in the street, or mm-hmm. shot in the forest, as happened to the young man with Stop Cop City. Again, I'm just stunned that the Cop City protests reminded me of Earth First. Earth First. When I was young, my best friends were involved in Earth First, and I was scornful of them because they were female. And as I already said, the men never help with the dishes or the cooking. And yet, I think that what my friends loved about Earth First was the sense of people power, mm-hmm. the sense that they weren't afraid of anything. And some of them went on to blow up trucks at Ross Island Sand and Gravel. I'm not saying Earth First was involved in that. See, now I'm getting really particular. Like when it came down to people who were aggressively organizing against the state, violence came from many sides. And I remember debating with people whether it was okay to liberate lab animals and let them loose in a field, right? There were a few people that did that. That was their regular protest. And they were, I think, Earth First adjacent. And yet looking back on it, that was nothing at all. We spent a lot of time arguing over something that really wasn't that big of a deal. But spiking trees or the ways that people ended up being rounded up and surveilled in Earth First, that was a big deal. And I think that's also what's happening for the people at Cop City. I guess that when I was young and I was watching my friends organize, I thought it was a little bit more like the junior league, you know, than what it is like now. And it wasn't really like the junior league then. So let me shift gears a little bit, Morgan, and ask you, what kind of people would you hope are going to show up to do more?
Who read what we're about, what we say we're about, and are down with participating in that. You know, we're pretty, you know, upfront about what we want to do and how we want to go about it. And bring it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to ask more specifics. Can I ask more specifics? Has anyone brought something more specific than a barbecue so far?
No, the barbecue actually came from our internally.
I love the idea of the barbecue.
Yeah.
One of the things that strikes me about social change in the modern age is that I think some of the things that destroyed our society were the toys. And when I was young and we were organizing against these things that we thought were really harsh truths and stuff. But what's really caused the more problems for us has been Amazon shopping and electrical cars, too. Things like that. Have you been following the lithium factory that's going to be built along the Oregon-Nevada border?
No.
It's a place where they're going to mine rare earth metals that are used to create the batteries for electric cars and cell phones. And I'm fascinated by anyone. If you're listening to this right now and you have some part of protesting against that, I would love to hear from you. But I think that some of the things that have damaged our society the most are actually the cultural things, the lifestyle things that sort of snuck in on us.
Didn't sneak. What? They didn't sneak. You know, they're there for a reason. They're there because it makes the best and highest profit. You know, that, and to make the best and highest profit, you have to exploit your workers the most. And it, once again, it's systematic. You know, I've not read about the lithium factory mine on the Oregon-Nevada border. This is the first time I heard about it. You know, I'm aware of the issues of mining. But I don't think protests are going to stop it.
There's such a wide buffet of ways that people can protest. That's always a fascinating thing. I would like to be the fly in the room for the Class Struggle Action Network and hear more about the ideas that people are putting on the table over there.
And that is my opinion, not the organizational.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. I get that. I get that. One of the other things that really gets me is that we talked for years about how Roe versus Wade was, the Roe v. Wade decision was under attack but I'm not sure if I ever really believed that anyone would reverse it. And they sure as hell did. And look at how that happened. As you're talking about the different ways to protest besides just protesting, I think that had a lot to do with it.
Roe versus Wade?
Yeah.
What aspect of it? It's like Obama having a majority Democratic Congress and not doing anything to protect it while using it as a fundraising tool and a cultural whip.
And even just watching the Republicans pack every single one of those judges, it really was all about the judges.
Yeah.
It's like a Tetris game of judges, of right-wing judges. I feel like that was the thing that really toppled it in the end.
And where were the Democrats?
On any level.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and they're playing some other game. And, you know, what I would look at is... Once again, this is me. Once again, I would look at it from a class struggle perspective. You would say, well, why are the unions donating money to the Democrats? Why are they dividing up their workers into, you know, pushing them to support various Democratic candidates and never getting anything out of it? Why this continual losing strategy that dates back to the 1880s?
Well, I mean, I feel like if you look at it like that, it's the plot of Legally Blonde 2. I bet everyone sits around thinks of this movie, and it had an animal rights, save the chihuahuas subplot, but really it was about Sally Field being a senator and her entire agenda involved just always being reelected.
Right.
And her attitude was, but if I'm not in office, then I can't do any of the good things.
Right.
And I think that is where that strategy, it's all about what is the end goal of the union or the Democrats or whatever.
Actually, it begins in that textile factory in North Carolina where she holds up the sign, Sally
Strike!
Field. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know who made that movie. Sally Field.
But she was in it.
Yeah, she was. She played the union organizer. And, you know, it's interesting. My mom is 92, and I was just gathering some oral histories from her this past summer. No. This is summer now. It was this past spring. And she organized a nurse's union at Fremont. No, at Washington Hospital in Fremont, California. Mm-hmm. And she talked about her and her friend, I think Nancy, who helped her do it. And what they discovered was that they were operating room nurses, registered nurses. They were the only workforce in the hospital that wasn't unionized.
Right.
They didn't even know that the groundskeepers, the housekeepers, they all had unions.
Yeah.
And sometimes I wonder if the biggest obstacle is what we don't know. Or who's hiding things from us. I don't know. And yeah, my mom. Anyway, you are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is Morgan Miller of the Class Struggle Action Network. They're moving forward. They're going to be doing some stuff. They've got a potluck in the park coming up Saturday, June 17th. That's at Laurelhurst Park. And it's remarkable that it was at Laurelhurst Park because some of the biggest sweeps that the city did of poor people were at Laurelhurst Park.
Well, they can have one more.
They could. Sweeping people out of Laurelhurst Park. That's Saturday, June 17th from 6 to 8 p.m. We've seen so many people in the streets, living in the streets for so many years. I'm curious about how it is that suddenly now it's such a big deal. I was just thinking about how for many years it used to be teenagers in downtown Portland. I don't think I ever saw one single media outlet ever do the story about why are there so many teenagers panhandling in downtown Portland. Yeah. But the obvious answer was the failed foster care system, which had already been failed for so many years. There's so many stories that play out right in front of us. But we're starting to run out of show. I wanted to ask you like just one or two last open-ended questions.
Okay.
And I'm not going to ask about your dog, Fergus, but I'm asking about him in my heart. Okay. I'm asking about him in my heart.
Okay.
This whole interview has been me trying not to ask you questions about you. It's not, I have failed terribly. But as we are looking at this new network of activists, people coming together to try to learn more about activism and learn what they could do, what do you want those people to know about your organization, about this organization?
This organization... we have a lot of experienced people, and we're gaining ground. It goes back, you know, it's a strategy that goes back decades. We picked it up directly out of Italian struggles and struggles in other of the Latin countries. But we can recognize it in other efforts, that we can identify here in this region. But it also goes back to the Wobblies and before, where you would go into a town and everybody was together, all the workers were together and suffering from the same conditions. It's no different. The root of what was the term I used? The way that the society is set up is exactly the same as it was in the 1860s, 1840s, and it's the same answer. Workers have to get together, defend their own positions, and it's also not good guys versus bad guys. It's just a systematic method of looking at the world.
And just before we wrap up, I mean, so much of what I see around here is tied in with real estate. And when we talk about, I'm not going to rabbit hole on the new King of England, but when I look at what happens in England, look at what happens in the UK, he's laughing, I know, but the New York Times and Forbes magazine actually had to do investigative reports about how much money Charles is actually worth, because it turns out he's a billionaire, and a lot of the money that his family has is stuff from colonialism that his family claims for their own, not the country, like all the crown jewels, the Koh-i-Noor diamond, which was stolen by the British military from whatever. All of it, they are claiming it as their own. It's not considered part of the national treasury. Right. And I look at Portland, like I look at it the same way. I remember an article years ago in the Willamette Week about the Sultan of Brunei owns right. property in Portland. And to me, it really does come down to who owns the stuff. And why do we have so many absentee? We've always have absentee property owners. But it's, to me, that's what's changed, the level of who owns our city from far away, and they're literally, it's speculation, and they profit from it. They don't have to work.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's true. We're the Koh-i-Noor diamond of the Pacific coast of America.
The Arkansas, the West Coast, we're the Koh-i-Noor diamond.
Yeah.
Of wherever the hell we're from.
Yeah, we're the crown jewel. Yeah. That's all true.
Okay.
Sorry for the difficult interview.
No. No, I mean, talking about social change is difficult, and trying to actually talk about how to effectively do it is difficult. And our city is very polarized, and in part, it's because, like I said, money comes in. Money shows up in this town, and it has always been that way. Who's the guy, John Reed, that wrote 10 days that shook the world? John Reed was a socialite. He was the child of, he was the scion of the people that owned the gas utility. It's like, this has always been a society town, and it's actually difficult, even when some of the affluent people see what the problem is, like John Reed, it's difficult to actually sit down and build something.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that's why you have to get up and do it one foot in front of the other.
Or roll. Sometimes you can log roll down the hill at the Laurelhurst Park. I'm just saying.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
I'm so there.
Okay. All right. That is it for our show. This is Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving, our guest, Morgan Miller. Thanks, Morgan, for being here.
You're ever so welcome, Lisa.
The Class Struggle Action Network. Save the Day. Potluck Barbecue Saturday, June 17th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Laurelhurst Park. You're going to want to build something. You're going to want to build something in the city, some kind of movement. You're going to show up there. Okay. And we're going to try not to talk about ourselves too much. And we're going to try to make space for other people to talk. And we're going to have really great structures for building
You can
things.
Get a hold of us. I'm sorry, on Facebook. And on the internet at class-struggle-actions.net.
Awesome. Awesome. Special thanks to KBOO Public Affairs Director Ender Black and Program Director Asia Hawthorne for making this all possible. KBOO Community Radio is reemerging. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kboo.org. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned.
Hi, I'm B.B. King, you know, the guy that plays that guitar called Lucille, and when I'm in Portland, I get my blues from KBOO. That's 90.7 FM on your radio. Please stay tuned, they might play one of my records.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. As we consider ecosystem service, we are moving toward a new method, an expanded system evaluation of the contribution of nature as species or habitat to financial analysis and understanding of true profit and loss when we use such services, conserve them or deplete them, as plus or minus on our economic balance sheet, as a measure of domestic product, and as data by which we declare policies, apply subsidies or incentives, and regulate the consumption or conservation of natural resources. It is mostly about the data. The invention of Excel as a tool for financial planning always seemed to me as a kind of illusion. The criteria and amounts selected for a budget, a magical function of selection, change the premises, thus change the conclusion. Thus, any budget can be made to balance. Any analysis can be made to confirm predetermined conclusions. We use gross national product as our primary measure of economic performance, compare and contrast it, and adjust the components in order to promote continuous expansion and measure of growth. It is a formulaic arrangement of data, susceptible to what is included and particularly to what is left out. And so, to account for the true value of an ocean economy, of associated inputs and outcomes, we need to understand that the established premises, the conventional parameters, must be adjusted to reflect a full picture of an inclusive calculation as a basis for assessment and reassessment of policy, profit, and national viability. As the ocean connects all economies, such change, while a more accurate calculation of value, represents a radical upheaval of conventional structures and behaviors worldwide. A 2020 report by a World Resource Institute high-level panel for a sustainable ocean economy offered some revised definitions, questions, and pathways forward. It concluded first that the data required to inform the change was actually available, contained in disparate studies and government statistics. Thus, the primary obstacle was not inadequate information, but rather the resistance to the idea that product includes social inputs, that natural capital was an acceptable asset value to include in the calculation, and that income as social benefit was to be included in the formula. The report suggested three fundamental questions as a framework for change. First, ask how will a decision change the wealth of an ocean balance sheet, including all produced assets by ports, for example, and non-produced assets by coral reefs, for example. Second, consider how will a decision change net national income or welfare, and how will those changes be distributed between different groups of people. And third, project how the decision will change ocean-based economic production and create new means to achieve social and economic goals. The report went on to recommend an internationally agreed framework for revised national accounting to avoid over-reliance on traditional GDP and lead or contribute to collaborative efforts to improve national ocean accounting operations, devise systems of execution, maintenance and collection of statistics, incentivize timely transfer, reduced barriers between agencies and offices, established new standards and different practices, developed cross-cutting platforms, tools, algorithms, and programs for data sharing, and new reporting tools applied to familiarize public and private leaders and legislators as a demonstrable commitment to change. The report makes for close reading, but the conclusion seems direct and simple. A. The data exists on which to include and base the change. B. The process is more a function of political will than illogical thinking. C. The oversight and legislative capacity exists to execute and surveil the new system. And D. The problem is primarily one of conventional thinking, vested interest in the old method, fear of change, and other resistance, even in the face of crisis, to a solution that would provide a context and justification for urgent strategies to conserve and sustain the natural and communal assets now threatened. Indeed, here, in the making, is a key action toward rescue. R for renewal, E for environment, S for society, C for collaboration, U for understanding, and E for engagement. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the Free Music Archive. an interactive library of high-quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that too. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle.
Your investment in community radio can go on with a planned gift to KBOO. Consider adding KBOO to your will or add KBOO as a beneficiary to your insurance and bank accounts. You can change your mind anytime if your circumstances change. But recognizing KBOO along with your family and friends in your legacy giving is a powerful commitment to media justice. Let us know if you add KBOO to your plans. We'd like to thank you for your considerate future gift. Contact us at 503-231-8032 or email development@kboo.fm to notify us of your plans.
I want you to get together.